Surely that must be some other Marion you were thinking of, not me. Hi, everybody. Before I even begin to share with you a little of my strength and hope and experiences, I want to pause just 1 minute to say thank you to the committee of the Georgia State Convention for allowing me to share just a little part of your wonderful convention. I don't know why I'm here, because I feel so inadequate. I'm not the speaker that Miriam mentioned. I'm only another alcoholic, and that's the way I want it to always be. I also want to say thanks to an aunt and uncle of mine and a cousin that I haven't seen since I was about 16 years old. They don't know a great deal about what happened to Marion Meacham after that little girl used to visit here in Atlanta. And I want to thank them for having the courage to come here this morning and be my friend and find out what happened to Marion Meacham in those few missing years that they lost track of me. And there are many, many others I want to thank, but there's not enough time. So just thanks to everybody for everything you've given me to take back to Charlotte, North Carolina with me. My name is Marion Meacham, and I think I'm about the happiest alcoholic in the building this morning. Not because I'm up here, because I'm scared to death. I'll tell you, I guess you can tell it out there by my voice. But I'm so grateful that I have been given another day of sobriety, another weekend of sobriety with the people that I love so much, because you loved me. Had it not been for you, I wouldn't have been here this morning. I'm sure of this. Why I'm an alcoholic worried me quite a number of years. This isn't important to me this morning. I'm wondering why I'm here sober. Why do I stand here trying to share with you when I should be in the prison over here at the federal or the state prison like the other girls that I've talked to throughout my short time in AA who are serving a life sentence for manslaughter? You see, I was a woman that picked up a gun in the latter part of my drinking days, loaded it, called my baby sister, who sits in the audience with us this morning, also a member of our fellowship, and told her I was coming to kill her because she had stolen the love of my oldest daughter. I went to her home. I stood facing Carolyn with the trigger ready to pull. Why should a power far greater than any human being cause the gun to drop from my hand? And we both began crying and ended in each other's arms. Why me? These are the things that's important this morning. Why was AA brought to me and given to me, and the people begged me to take it? They put the literature in my hand. They picked me up in the cars. They made it so easy. When I watched the little Hindu woman crawl into an AA meeting in San Fernando, Trinidad, like a beaten, whipped animal. And even her own alcoholic brothers in the group wouldn't get close to her. She was the untouchable. And here I am, an American woman, given all the love and the respect of my alcoholic brothers and the Al-Anon wives and the Al-Ateens. Why should it be me? These are the things that go through my mind over and over and over again every night. I don't deserve them. I did everything in the world I could to shove them away from me. You see, I was given an opportunity in 1955, begged and pleaded with to accept the program that you people had to offer, told that it was a way, and I desperately wanted a way out then. But through false pride and arrogance and hatred and resentment and rebellion, I wouldn't take what you wanted to give me. So so I didn't deserve the other chance in 1959. Why me? Yes, I think there's a purpose in every one of us being in this fellowship. I think we're the few chosen ones. Why, I'll never know, and I mustn't question anymore. I must just go when I'm asked and try each day to give a little hope, a little happiness, and a little love to some other alcoholic, because you gave it to me. I started out as most of you. I think where we came from is mostly alike in nearly all of our cases. I can't blame my drinking and the alcoholism on my early life. I had a good home. I had a happy home full of love from a wonderful mother and father. I was the oldest of five children. I had everything in the world given me that was necessary to prepare me for a useful, successful, and happy life. And I also was taught dangers of alcoholism, because there had been some in my family past. And somehow or other it seemed that every one of the people, my people, that Mom knew that ever tasted alcohol usually ended up drunk. They found sobriety, yes, some of them. And some of them had to die drunk, DTs, convulsions. But I knew the dangers. I knew all this. And so I can't blame anything about my later life on this. I came up very close to the church. At 13, I was teaching Sunday school, a junior boys class in a little Methodist Protestant church in Charlotte, North Carolina. And at 17, I felt that I had been chosen to enter the medical mission field. I left home and attended a little college in Cleveland, Tennessee, Bob Jones College, to prepare for this. I know now that the things that I felt in my heart were false, were make-believe, because, you see, I wanted so much to know a God that I could understand. And I somehow think that the search that I'd spent a lifetime looking for ended when I walked to the door of the Roswell Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1959. Because I had to be introduced to a God that I could understand through people like you. This is the way he had to reach me. And this is the way I had to come to know him. So I think I was looking, I was full of fears, I was full of anxiety, and I was all mixed up and I was all confused, because never in my life could I understand why I shouldn't respect the Catholic belief, the Jewish belief. I always somehow felt that everybody had to be loved by God, but every way I turned, well, there was judgment or punishment. I was reminded of this. And through letting the fear become an obsession, I lost sight of the love and the wonderful forgiveness. And the fact that this power, this God that I wanted to know, wanted above all, Marion, to be happy and to enjoy life. And I had to come to you to find it. This is why I'm also so grateful to you. And in this little school, I began to search for the right answer. I wanted to know who's right. Am I wrong? Am I on the wrong track? And through trying to find the answers to everything, trying to find out why, and trying to understand completely, I dug too deep in different cults, different religions, different philosophies, and I lost all sight of anything that I had ever wanted to believe. I didn't want any part of this God that they talked me about. I didn't want any part of this church full of its hypocrites, its pious, its gossipy tongues, its jealousy, its envy, its greed, its hate. I didn't want any part of this. You have taught me, if I continue to try to learn to know myself, I won't have time to look around for these defects and shortcomings in my fellow man. And in trying to look for him in this little school, I blinded myself to my own faults. You see, I think somehow I had all the tendencies, as Dr. Earle said last night, to make me an alcoholic from the first drink. Here was a strong characteristic which remained with me till 59. I never in my life liked to admit defeat within myself. And I always was able to look around and blame it on circumstances, on other people, but not Marion. Marion always had a reason. And I found my excuse. I left this little school after 2 years. I returned home. I took a job with the telephone company, learning the trade of a switchboard operator. At 18, 19, I had no opportunities to drink. I was still under very strict, rigid rules in my home. And up until I was 21, I wasn't allowed to mingle with these people. At 21, during these 2 years back from Bob Jones, I had met a man, fell in love with him, married him. And it was shortly after our marriage in June on a Christmas Eve that I finally had the opportunity to taste this elixir, this thing that other people talked of that Mom had forbidden me to take, me to touch. Because you see, my husband was able to handle it. And I can add today that he still can handle it. He's always respected it. And he has no problem with alcohol. So on a Christmas Eve, they picked me up from the telephone company at 11 o'clock. I was already mad because, you see, they could play all day and celebrate, and I had to work. Maybe the resentments of having to work after I had thought that I could stay home and be a wife and a mother had already begun to enter into me. I don't know. But they picked me up at 11 o'clock that night, and they were gay, and they were happy and laughing, and I was tired and mad, and I'd lost out on a day of fun. We went to a friend's home. My husband says, "Marion, go in the kitchen. Why don't you fix us a little bite to eat?" And they pulled out a Chinese checkers board. As I walked through the door of the kitchen of a friend's home, there was a half a gallon jug of white corn whiskey sitting on the table. Somehow or other, this whiskey seemed to be as a magnet to me. I couldn't take my eyes off of it. I listened to the laughter in the living room, the gaiety, and a lot of thoughts began running through my mind. Why can't you drink like normal people? You're different from your aunts, your uncles, your father. There's no difference. If you handle it with temperance, there's no sin in it. You too can be a lady and a part of society. Do the things that other people do. All of these things. I walked over to the table. I took down an iced tea glass and I poured my first drink of whiskey alone in a kitchen on Oakland Avenue in Charlotte, North Carolina. And I might add here, from the very first drink I poured, there was nothing social about it. I poured a half an iced tea glass full of white corn whiskey. And if you think that's social for any lady, I got news for you. I put it to my lips, and I might say that I loved the taste of alcohol in any form until the day I took my last drink. I turned it down, no chaser, no nothing, and I drank this way the rest of my drinking days, usually, unless I had to put up a front of being a lady or trying to be. I walked back into the living room. I wasn't conscious but a few minutes, and they tell me that I fell flat on my face. I was taken home, put to bed by my husband, and the next morning I came to in my room, not knowing what had happened or anything about the effects of that drink. What did I find that I liked? It wasn't just the taste. I think from my first drink I found complete escape from myself, from a God that I feared and I hated and I felt unworthy of. And I used alcohol for escape, I'm sure. I didn't recognize this at the time from the beginning. So So you see, I didn't have the 15 years, as Dr. Earle mentioned, to play around with alcohol. I progressed very rapidly over that line to the point of no return. The first 3 years, I made it a point to drink only with my husband on special occasions. But when I drank with him, I always slipped three or four in my glass if we had to mix it to his one. I always had a bottle hid somewhere in the cabinet for just this occasion. But with only special occasions, and maybe later he allowed me to learn to mix the cocktails, a cocktail before dinner, then the occasional weekend parties. The first 3 years that I was married, we were blessed with three of the most wonderful children that God could ever give a woman. I have a daughter who is today 23, will be 24 in January, a school teacher in Florida. And I have twins, Bub and Sis, who will be 23 next June. Everything. But even in these 3 short years, I was searching, looking, escaping, trying to. And when my babies were 6 months old and it became necessary to go back to work, I went to work with International Harvester Company as receptionist PBX operator. And I was thrown in a crowd of people that loved to drink and partied every weekend. I was making my own money now. I was beginning to get a little self-sufficient and a little more egotistical. And I began to pick out the people that I liked to mingle with, the people that liked to drink. And Charlotte was dry, and I made it a point to let the salesmen and customers know if they wanted any favors from Marion, bring me a fifth from South Carolina, and I had no trouble getting. I might say that we find the people that we like to mingle with in any crowd, whether it's drinking, church, AA, anywhere else. And you don't have to take it, but I would like to say to the newcomer this morning, when you're ready to accept this program, try to find the people with a sparkle in their eyes and a smile on their face and hang on to their coattail, because I'll guarantee you, you got the best chance of making the program this way. And so I picked these people out. We began to invite them into our home, and my husband allowed this, and every weekend our parties began from late Friday afternoon into the wee hours of Monday morning. This particular time, I could drink anyone in the crowd under the table and still drive the car, still put them to bed, still get up and go to work with a shower and a bite of breakfast. I had no difficulty with putting it away, not recognizing what was happening. It was just a matter of about a year later, I moved from this job into a government job, communications office. And it was there that we were allowed to start meeting in the offices and drink in the middle of the afternoon. And then I'd go home with a rosy glow and I'd start drinking my cocktail or my straight drink before supper, before dinner. And it was then that someone else began to notice what was happening. Changes were taking place. The war tensions were heavy, and my brother came home from service. We were sitting in the living room of our home one night about this time, drinking, my husband and John and I. And suddenly my brother looked at me, and I'll never forget the look as he stared at his oldest sister. And he said, "Sis, for God's sake, cut it out or slow down. You're not handling your whiskey like you used to." And I remember thinking a second, and then the resentments, the bitterness, who were they to tell me I wasn't handling my whiskey? Why didn't they tend to their own business? Another step of alcoholism. I began to look at my husband, and he began to watch me. We cut off our communication, and I began to hate this man because he was trying to watch me. He was trying to help me, really, but I couldn't see it this way. And then I began to think, well, why doesn't he tend to his own business? Mama did this to me all my life. I moved on. Another step of alcoholism, the slipping, the scheming, the hiding. All of these began to set in rapidly now. In the early 40s, about 44, they had moved their offices out to the old shell plant on the York Road. This time I was put in complete charge of my government communications office, public buildings administration, and I had 6 very faithful employees under me. A government car, government ration card, a private office with a lock on a door, and my closest supervisor here in Atlanta, Georgia. He very rarely checked up on me every 3 or 4 months. My employees were good to me because of my sister working with them, I suppose. And maybe I like to hope they think that this wasn't the woman that grew up with, that I didn't want to be doing these things. And at this time, I had gone into the drinking from early morning until maybe 7, 8, 9, 2. I woke one morning at about 3 o'clock lying in the floor of this big building. I'll never forget a pink midi blouse, wool dress, my hair sleeved, on the floor, face dirty. I don't know how long I'd been passed out. But you see, I had gone into the phase of alcoholism where one afternoon just before this, I went home from my office after drinking all afternoon with my bosses. It was after dark, and I heard my 3 kids, who weren't babies anymore, run to the front door, and I heard Sissy's little squeal, "Mommy's home." And I remember opening the door, and as I started through the front door, I staggered and fell into the front room. I'll never forget those 3 kids as they stopped, the look in their eyes, the fear, the hurt, the puzzlement, and they began to back off. And I picked myself up and I walked over to Gail, my oldest one, and I reached out to put my arm around her shoulder, and she drew off. She didn't want this woman to touch her anymore. So you see, from this day on, I tried to seek oblivion every minute of the time I was conscious. I hated myself. I think every alcoholic reaches this point if he has a child and sees that look in his eyes. Yes, we steal. We steal the material things. I too reached this phase in the latter part of the 50s. I stole from the petty cash at the office. I stole from Mom's pocketbook. I stole from my kids' piggy banks. And I even sank so low in the latter 50s that it was necessary to steal the vanilla flavoring, the lemon extract, the rubbing alcohol from the shelf of an A&T store where my mother traded with since I was at her. Alcoholist. God forbid that you have to sink that low. Listen to our experiences. Don't compare your story with mine. But don't think because you're a woman or you're a different color from other people or you're a man from a certain family with an education, don't think anything can help you. If you continue to fight this thing and you continue to gamble your chances long enough and circumstances make it so, to grab these things, to do these things, in order to get back in the position, as Julian said, to make a little more money, to get a little more to keep living on, you too will do. Just be grateful this morning that you've got a choice, a freedom of choice, and no one else in the world can ever make you make your choice. But if you choose to continue trying your reservation, be ready to pay the price. And sometimes it's a pretty rough price to pay, believe me. I began to have first warning signals about this time. My first one, and I think every one of them had these signals we've heard mentioned so often in the speaker's program, was the day that I turned the government car over in a drunken stupor. I was on my way home from work, off route, and I managed to be near a hosiery mill on the old Pineville Road in Charlotte, and I staggered into the mill. I called my head mechanic back at the plant. I told him to get the marine wrecker and get that quick because I was in trouble. They knew I got in that car too drunk to stand up. And through their goodness and their kindness, they had that record there in about 5 minutes. They got me away before the police arrived. They got the car away. And when the FBI was sent down from Washington to investigate, those kind people lied for Marion. They said the car had been stolen. They didn't know who was driving. To save my face and my family disgrace. And my job was bad. I should have recognized this as a sign from a power far greater than us, trying to shock me to my senses that I was headed for destruction and headed fast. But I wouldn't read the sign. Old ego, this job couldn't continue to run without Marion here to supervise. Alcoholism. After all, I'm a little special. And I didn't even thank the people. My next warning sign hurt a little bit more, and it was when I got the subpoena and was taken to Judge Gatlin's court, the threat of my three children being taken from me. I went to this court with the firm belief that this man I was married to caused all of this. And if this judge would just straighten his character out, Marion never would want another drink. It's so pathetic, and we believe it. We believe it. We make ourselves believe it. And I get up there, and I was so convincing and so convinced myself that I convinced Judge Willard R. Gatlin, and brother, that's a big job in the city of Charlotte. And he said, Marion, I think you're right, and I think you deserve the opportunity to stay home and be the mother that you want to be, and I'm going to give it to you. So turn in your resignation, get your office in order, and stay home and we'll see what happens. I should have been grateful again, but again I hated. He and my husband, I figured, had planned this, and now they were taking the money away from it that was necessary to buy what I had to have to drink. And I began to figure, and I was able to convince him it would take me quite a few months to get my office in order. And so I managed to leave the office, the government office, one day under 5 years. And when I left, I took my retirement check, one lump sum, so I wouldn't be without money until I saw what happened. I began to try the different routes of controlling my drinking, of not drinking, of going on the wagon. You know them all. But invariably, I ended up drunk. Fall came, my money running out. Hating more, resenting more fears entered. I decided and convinced my husband I should return to work, and I went back to work as a booker on motion picture film row. Here I was with people that liked to drink more than any I'd ever worked with. If you don't know theater people, they're quite a bit like us. They've got the alcohol in them, most of them. And there it was part of my job as booker to drink with my exhibitors as long as I acted like a lady, but I began to abuse this privilege very rapidly. And I had my third warning signal getting a little rough. I was preparing dinner one night, barefooted, drunk, and a pot of Western oil caught fire on the burner of my stove, and I grabbed for it, missed it, and turned it over on my feet. I was carried in Memorial Hospital emergency ward with no flesh left on either feet, burned completely off, dropped like an overcooked chicken. My mother was standing there. She was a nurse at this hospital for about 17 years. They began to call the doctors in, and I heard Mama and the tears streaming say, it wouldn't have happened if she hadn't have been drunk. The doctors came in, five of them, during the 4 months that I lay in this hospital, and said her feet can never heal normally. She'll be left a cripple. It's going to be a long skin grafting process. I left there at the end of 4 months on crutches. There was never any skin grafting performed on my feet. And I think all of you know I wasn't left a cripple. A power greater than us that I somehow feel has a very special love for we the alcoholics who find AA or a way of sobriety and happiness. I swore that Easter that I lay there in that hospital or sat there and looked out the window at my three kids, hiding the Easter eggs that my mom had died, wearing the clothes that my mother had had to make so my children could have Easter outfits. And I swore to God I'd never again put whiskey to my lips. I got out of this hospital. As soon as I got off my crutches and back on my job, the ego, the arrogance, drink even more now. My job was on thin ice. I began looking around. I found me a perfect setup, a small film exchange opening in Charlotte. And I got the job as office manager, booker, only employee staying within the office. One other man who stayed in a card game, his brother owned the company, and he was district manager. We didn't interfere with each other. By 1952, I'd cut myself off completely from my family, my children, decent human beings. I'd withdrawn into the well of the prison of loneliness and its hell. I knew the other jails and things later on. I don't think there was any jail in the world worse than this prison of loneliness that we lock ourselves into. I had only one friend in 1952, and my friend couldn't be a human being. I wouldn't accept the love. It wasn't because they didn't want to give it to me. I wouldn't accept it. Ego, pride, false pride. And I think this power that loves the alcoholic so much, whom I choose to call God, gave me this one friend in 52 so I could have something to hold to, something to cling to that loved me and wanted me and needed me just as I was, and as Jim says, in spite of myself. And mine had to be a little white, deaf English bulldog called Mr. Trouble. And he needed me because when he was born, he was bleeding to death and his mother would have killed him had I left her with him. So I rushed into the house with Mr. Trouble. I got me a medicine dropper and hot milk and I stopped the blood and I sat all night long with a bottle. I was drinking gin then and fed Mr. Trouble, and then morning came, the sun came up. And I was still a little drunk, but I carried Mr. Trouble to the vet, and I said, "Please, Dr. Armstrong, you've got to save him." I didn't realize then, but this dog was very important to me. God knew why I needed him. He knew I'd reached a phase that no one in the world would even stay in a house with me. But he would, and he loved me, but he hated alcohol, but he never left me. And Doc said, "If I operate, he'll die. He's too weak." And I cried and was so drunk that to get me quiet, they decided to try. And Mr. Trouble lived. He lived until 1959 in October. And during these years that would have come, I attempted suicide 3 times. And it was due to Mr. Trouble, who brought help to me, or brought me to my consciousness long enough to call for help, that my life was saved. I raised him on a hot water bottle in the desk drawer, and I had the gin bottle, and I'd get drunk and I'd cry and I'd tell Mr. Trouble all my troubles. That's why I named him Mr. Trouble. And so I stayed close. I tried to read different books people would give me. I couldn't read. I began to try the woman's club, and I began to get back. I'd gone back to every phase I ever knew, and I didn't know that. I thought I was just a no good drunk. 55, I had another subpoena to Judge Gatlin's court. Scared this time. There wasn't any too much fight. And I went up there not knowing. I was too dumbfounded. Maybe my brain was beginning to be affected. But with no argument, just they'd have to do what they had to. And as we sat there with Judge Gatlin, and he looked at me, I'll never forget the look. He said, "Miss Meacham, you're not a bad woman. You're a sick one. But you know, you can be helped. There's a group of people here in the city of Charlotte called Alcoholics Anonymous. And they help people like you if you'll accept their help. And I feel that you need this opportunity. And I'm going to give you another chance and we'll see what happens. I turn you over to 4 of these people with AA. You go. You try to listen and try to learn. And in the meantime, you and your husband go to the mental health clinic. And then we'll see how it goes. I hate it again. I might say today I consider Judge Willard Gatlin my sponsor and Odell. Because you see, he forced me to expose myself to you people. And I had to get there this way. And you planted the seed then, even though I didn't want it. I wouldn't take it. We went to the mental health clinic, and I began to tell them about this awful guy I was married to. They began to agree with me. But they decided that the change, that I needed to change, that there was a real good hospital over here in North Carolina called Butner, North Carolina. And get me away from this terrible man, I should go up and just rest about 30 days. Brother, I got mad on. Why didn't they send him? He's the one that had the problem. And so I go home and I tell Keela, I said, you told them to make me go up there, and I don't need to go where there's people like this. I don't want to leave my kids. And he looked at me. He says, I know you don't even need this AA thing. You don't need anything, any hospital. The only thing in the world you need is a little willpower and determination, Marion. And you know what happened. I was straight to that telephone, and I dialed that mental health clinic. And I said, you call Camp Butner, and they'll give me to 4 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. I'll be up there if I have to walk or hitchhike every step of the way up there. Alcoholics. Get even. Get even paying back. Oh, God forbid that I ever be this disgusting again. I went to Butner, and I think we are so lucky here in America, in our states, to have these wonderful hospitals and homes and mental health clinics and many, many ways to help the alcoholic. But you'll never convince me that there's anything in the world, even Alcoholics Anonymous, that can help an alcoholic until he first wants sobriety and he wants it more than anything else on the face of the earth, without any reservation. And I think the key to a happy sobriety is when we become willing and ready to accept the fact that we're an alcoholic. We're going to be one until the day that they shovel the dirt on top of us. And I think this is your happiness begins to come. And I wasn't ready to do this. I was ready to look for faults in other people as I did at 17. I went there, I listened. And I began to make one of the most fatal mistakes of my life. I began to compare my story with other stories. And this convinced me that I wasn't like those people. They were drunk, alcoholics, but not me. Potential. I had another few years to trust, see. And in the meantime, I was going to prove everything they said was wrong, that I'd in the end learn to handle my whiskey. This was the same attitude. I went back home. I went to AA. I was selfish. I was greedy. All the good things I wanted to lick the cream off the top. And one day in the club, Odell looked at me and he says, Marion, it's time you went home and you sat down and took a fearless moral inventory of your own little dirty, conceited, arrogant, egotistical self. And brother, when he said that, I hated Odell L. again for another few years. I thought, well, I didn't belong here in the first place. It made me come. I wouldn't have come. And so I began to wait for my chance, my opportunity. And it was then that I listened. Not many women talked back then in Charlotte. And the men came up and they began to talk of the jails and the horrors that happened in the mental institute where they were thrown. And then they began to talk of the substitutes and all this, and I thought, well, the stupid fools, they ought to be in straitjackets in mental institute, but not Marion Meacham. Her family would never let her go to jail. They're an old family, and she's got too much pull. I'm sorry to have to tell you that I continued to fight with the bottle to prove those people wrong. And I finally reached, in the latter 50s, I began to make the jails, yes. I had to make the institution. I made the hospital. And as I told you before, I reached a phase that in order to get back on my part-time job that I managed to hold to until a year and a half after I came into AA, I'd have to crawl to the kitchen, crawl to the bathroom, and any bottle that I saw, I learned them all well, how much percent, what percent. I had to drink it like an animal. This had to be, I suppose, for me, in order to make me surrender and accept completely. And if it took it, I might say that I think I've been one of the happiest women in AA around my section of the country for the past 4 years. Not completely happy, but I'm an alcoholic. And I'll always have to have problems. I'll have to have a certain amount of unhappiness to help me start counting my gratitude. I left AA, I stayed dry 13 months. The end of 13 months, I'd taken on one full-time job, two part-time jobs. I'd already begun to go back to drinking. After 13 months at the beer stage, my husband gave me a can of beer one night after I got off from the Coliseum, thinking it would just help me sleep. He didn't know. He knew nothing, and he still knows very little of alcoholism. And so that night he thought, well, a beer will help us sleep. I knew what they told me might and could happen. But here was my opportunity. If it didn't work, I put the blame right back on him. We went home that night, and this began the point of my life where life became a complete and a total hell on earth. Because you see, within a matter of just a very few months, I had gone very rapidly. The beer made me drunk. My husband cut it off. He forbid any more. And so I turned to the vodka thinking he couldn't smell that. The blackouts began. My oldest daughter found her mother too unbearable to look at. She left home to go live with this kid sister of mine that you see around with me a lot. And I'd gone to the wine by the latter part of the 1956s, this rapidly. I became like a zombie. I think now that all desire really had left to live. But my dad came home and he was desperately ill, and we were told that he was given 2 weeks, about 6 weeks that he could live, but perhaps he'd be gone in 2 weeks, cirrhosis of the liver or cancer of the liver. And I was sitting one afternoon by my dad's bedside holding his hand, for he took hold of mine, and reeking with the cheap wine. And Dad looked at me, and remember, my dad was an alcoholic who maintained sobriety for quite a number of years before he died. Through the church he found his. And Dad looked straight into my eyes, and he said, "Baby, don't give up. Keep searching. Keep looking. You're going to find the end. But I want you to remember one thing, and don't you ever forget it, Marion. God does answer prayer." I thought, answer my prayer? How could God answer my prayer? I'd quit praying, except one prayer. I never prayed to get over a drunk. For years I would fall in bed drunk, and I'd mumble the words, "God help me. God help me. Have mercy on me." So I think God helps those who are not capable of helping themselves. Because the prayer that you prayed this morning, the one moment of silent prayer, I think this is the prayer that my God answered, that kept me alive and brought me back through the doors of an AA meeting in 59. So every man or woman that's prayed this prayer are my sponsors too. Thank you for helping me when I couldn't help myself. I began to stay drunk around the clock. Dad was dead in about 2 weeks. Very rapidly the jails began, rested drunk, barefooted, in shorts, hair not combed, dirty feet, thrown in the city jail, driving under the influence, drunk. I told them who I was, what lodge my husband belonged to, where I came from. And they only laughed and said, "You're just another drunk woman." I stayed there. My husband thought it'd do me good to think about myself. Next morning at 9 o'clock, I thought surely he'll bring his wife a dress and a pair of shoes and a comb so she won't have to go into the city courtroom like this. But he didn't. They opened the cell doors. They began to herd us out, the white and the black, the prostitutes and the people I'd looked down my nose at. They herded Marion Meacham out, barefooted, in short, hair not combed, dirty feet. My cousin, Jet, was on the stand that morning, and I had deteriorated so much that he didn't even recognize the little girl that he had watched grow up. This is alcoholism. So from here on out, I was called by number, not name. Lost my license once, swore I'd never drink again, got them back, had them 1 month, lost them the second time, driving drunk, 4 years this time. My probation was lifted last January under the state of North Carolina. And I came into AA and made a decision to turn my will and my life over to God, as I can understand Him, and you people. Everybody started doing things for me and helping me. And they allowed me to drive under probation for 2 years, a year and a half. This is when the suicide attempt started. My baby girl left home. My youngest son, my only son, left home. And by September the 25th, 1959, there was nobody there but trouble, myself, a bottle, and a man that I hated with a passion. It was this day about 4:15. I had drank my wine to the usual stage, gone in and fell on the bed to sleep it off, when I was awakened by someone tugging at my arm. I opened my eyes and I thought I was dreaming. You know, with wine you have these weird dreams and things. But I reached down and Mr. Trouble wasn't at the foot of my bed where he always stays, and I knew I wasn't. I sat to the side of the bed and I went to put my shoes on. And the man gave me a jerk and he says, "You don't need those where we're taking you." I saw another man standing in the door and I walked on. They pulled me on toward him. They snapped the handcuffs on my wrist. Between the two of them, they led me from the front door of my home, and I saw the sheriff's car parked there. I knew where I was going. I'd heard the people talk in Butner AA meetings of Dix Hill, the snake pit of North Carolina for the alcoholics. Scared, yes. Frightened to death. Too tired to fight. But I felt as though my heart would break in two, that they would do this to me. It wasn't the answer. I looked back at the front door of my home, and things began to happen to Marion Meacham that I know I had no control of, was not of myself. I saw this man that I'd hated so standing in the door that had signed the commitment papers to send me. And instead of hating, I only felt sorry for him. He didn't understand. He didn't know. He was trying to help me in the only way that he knew how to help me. We got in the car. They put me in. They drove me to the county jail. They led me back the long corridor to the bullpen. And another miracle happened to Marion Meacham. As they opened the jail door and told me to go in, and the door slammed, the lock turned. From the girl of 17's mind that entered the little college in Tennessee came back a verse that she was asked to choose as her life's verse the day she registered. Romans 8:28. All things work together for good to to them that love God. Everything has a purpose. And then from the vague past, you see, my mind was too fogged up to think. I remember the group of people in 55 in the little Myers Park group in Charlotte. And I remember them saying together something that went, and all I could think of was, accept the things you cannot change. Accept. And then I thought of AA. This was my answer. At this moment, I wanted sobriety and I wanted it more than anything. And I felt that God would give me the strength to live the next 30 days. And I knew when I got out that if I had to crawl every bit of the way back, and I mean that I'd get to you people and if necessary, I'd get down on my hands and knees and beg you to give me another chance. But you didn't make this necessary. For 8 days, I began doing things that I'd heard read in these 12 steps, not realizing I was letting the steps work in my life. And this is the way I had to do it. I'd heard them say something about the inventory. I think I turned my will as best I could or made a decision when that AA thought came to my mind in the line of the Serenity Prayer. And I sat and I looked through the barred window and the only thing I could see was the gray brick wall outside. And I'd look up, I could see a spot of blue. If you've ever been in that position, you know and you have no doubt that if you're searching for God, somehow I think you always find Him in the jail cells, in the places where there's the most suffering, on the bedside of a drunken DT. Whether He's needed, He's there. And I begin to look up at that speck of blue, and I begin to think, oh, how grateful I'd be and how lucky, and if I could just walk down the trade street of Charlotte and hold my head up and be able to look men and women in the eyes and not be ashamed. If I could just have my self-respect back. And if they can teach me how to get my self-respect back, then I know I can get the respect of those three wonderful children. And if God doesn't see fit for me to never have their love again, if they'll only respect me, I've got a chance that someday they will love me. And then I begin to think, God, as I understand Him, and I begin to understand Him for me, what I say is my convictions. You don't have to listen. And I begin to think, the beauty of the leaves, as Jim said, yes, I know what God looks like. I think I do. This flower I had on this morning, to me, that's a message for my buddy. I love you, Marion. I got a job I want to do, and I want to use you. Forget yourself. Let me channel my love, my forgiveness, and my hope through you. You're just an instrument, Marion. He told me that. This is what I felt. The smile on my children's face. The light that I stole that day that I fell through the front door. I only saw come back to two of them about 3 years ago. My oldest daughter, the first year, she accepted AA immediately. Bubby did. And my baby girl rejected AA until the day that I was in Spartanburg talking to Jim in February, a year and a half. The light hadn't come back to her eyes. But it's beginning to come now. She and I had dinner the Monday before we left. And I helped her choose her going away suit for her wedding. And we planned her wedding breakfast together. It's coming back. I'll get it. But I know I have a respect. And she knows that her mother is only here because she wants to try to help some other mother or father be given back to their sons and daughters. Because I'm not ashamed of what I've... I found in AA, and I'm proud that I'm here trying to do something about it. I am ashamed of the terrible things I had to share with you. But God, as I understand, has forgiven me. And I've forgiven myself. The stars, the moon, the ocean. These are the places I see God. Your faces. I look at you and he comes back up here to me this morning. From each one of you. It's not me. It's you. These are the things I began to think about. I went on to the mental institute. And a gal that's here with me today could tell you we had a rough time. And she was the only girl that would even listen about you wonderful people. She wanted to hear about you. And she listened. And I looked at her in the hall yesterday afternoon. I saw the twinkle in her eyes. The look of the girl that walked out of that place. Hope. Happiness. Yes, I saw God in her eyes too. I came home from Dixiel. I had my final test. How much I wanted alcohol. Wanted to stay sober. My husband told me as we drove up in the drive, Marion, I got to tell you something before you go in the house. I waited. You see, my son, my twin son and daughter was not there. My oldest girl was in college. But I had known I'd had one friend inside that front door that was going to be there just licking me and loving me. And that was my little old Mr. Trouble. And I could hold him once again until I could get in touch with you people. And he'd give me strength and hope. Peculiar looks and he says, I couldn't write you. I didn't want to upset you. But while you were in Dix Hill, I had Mr. Trouble put to sleep. He wasn't good for you, Marion. You loved him too much. I turned around and my hatred began to come back. Why should he kill something because it loved me? Why? And as I looked at him, I felt sorry for him once again. Into my mind came the thought, all things work together for good. Not one, not some, all things, except the things you cannot change. I walked into my room, I locked the doors. And I cried. I love that little dog. He meant a great deal to me. I know today, had he been there, I probably would have locked myself in with him once again. And I wouldn't have gotten to you people. And God, as I understand him, knew me far better than I knew myself. So he took me, everything I had away from me. My children, Mr. Trouble. My respect was, self-respect was gone. I was stripped of everything. And so I asked my husband, I said, do one favor for me, and I'll not ask you any more favors. Tomorrow night, will you drive me? I'd found the Roswell group that met on the old park road. And leave me at the road as you go to work. I want to go back to my people. And I can tell you this, and I mean it. Nothing in the world will ever come between me and Alcoholics Anonymous ever again. He let me out. He went on to town, and I walked up to the door. I could see them through the window drinking their coffee, the laughter. And I began to think, will they want me? I couldn't blame them. As I walked in the front door, they turned and their smiles beamed. And they said, hello, Marion. We've been waiting on you. We knew you'd be back. And they put their arms around me. This was the beginning of the happiest life for a woman. I can't tell you. I couldn't begin to tell you. You just don't put these things into words. But I was willing now to sit, to listen, to learn, to do whatever they told me to do. And God seemed to open up his treasure chest of blessings and dividends and riches. And it began to shower down, and I hadn't been able to pick them up fast enough. Not because I deserve them. I don't even deserve the bride. But because that he loves us and he wants to do something, and people love us. Non-alcoholics love us. Once we make up our mind to do something about our problem and start. What has AA given me? Way of life. Many, many things. I could stand up here a week and wouldn't even scratch the surface. And I'll close. I've probably talked too long, and forgive me if I have. I didn't mean to. But I feel I must tell you just a few of the things that have meant so very much to me. First and most important to me is through AA and people like you, I was introduced to this God that I can understand. And he's my friend. He's my buddy. He's close to me. He's alive. He's here today. Everywhere. He wants me to be happy. He wants me to be gay. And he knows I'm going to make mistakes, many of them. But he knows and wants me to know that as long as I'm doing the best that I can to practice the principles that you have taught me, to let the 12 steps be applied in my life, that when I lie down each night and can look in the glass at myself and say, Marion, you've done the best you could today, but not enough. Keep trying. I'll learn through the mistakes I made in profit time. I have nothing to fear. No man, no God that I can understand could punish me as long as I'm doing the best that I can. You people have taught me to pray the way that I can pray. Not like I stood in Bob Jones or the street corners of the city of Charlotte many years ago. I don't pray this way. I can't. Perhaps you can. But I just sort of talked to him out in the garden this morning. Make my mind clear and receptive for the job you want me to do or you want to use me in. Fill my heart with your love. This to me is the most important. If I can just somehow be willing to let God remove all my old self and this in my heart and fill it up with his love, the love that you people channel to me, there's nothing to worry about. I can bring hope and happiness if the love's in my heart. You've given me those three children back. The oldest daughter has sat with me and heard my story. And I think one of the greatest dividends of AA was the day in Charleston. The first time, and I looked at Gail, and the tears began to stream. And I wanted so much to try to tell them how I worked the 12 steps. But God wouldn't let me do it. I said, my name is Marion Meacham. I'm an alcoholic. And tears began to stream down Gail's face and mine. But there was a look of love and compassion and respect in that girl's eyes that I'll never forget. She tells me now, she says, Mama, as I look out through that class of second graders, I see my face in the faces of many of those children. And she said, one of the greatest experiences in the world is to keep them to have the little conference with them. And she says, you know, Mom, I got a story too. And she says, when I finish and look at that kid and say, the little girl I told you about was me, and he breaks down and cries, and I put my arms around him. She says, I know how you feel, Mom. I got a story too. Yes, you Alateens have a story. And you feel this feeling that we alcoholics feel. You Al-Anons have a story. And you too are a channel of the language of the heart and the love. This is what you've given me. You've taken away my fears. And you've given me moral courage. You've given me the courage to keep pushing forward to the goal that you gave me. And when the road gets rough and the going gets hard, to remember that I never walked this road alone. You are with me in spirit and prayer. God's with me always, as I understand Him. Recently I've gone through some terrible problems, faced some terrible things for me, because I had trouble growing up and making decisions. And I lay there one night and I saw a shadow on the door and my heart nearly stopped. And I had my little dog, Mr. Spider, with me. I walked to the door and I looked out, went back. I realized the fear was there. And I began saying the Serenity Prayer. A line that meant so much to me. I'll never walk through the valley of shadow of death alone. Because you see, we alcoholics have to go through the valleys before we can reach the tops of the mountains. And we'll be going through them quite often. But I am with thee. You are with me. And the moral courage when people begin to criticize us, and a lot of other things. This is life. This helps to make us grow. And I have only one desire in my heart, that I can continue to strive to learn to love rather than be loved. And to forgive rather than be forgiven. And if God will help me to understand my fellow man, it doesn't matter whether they understand me or not. And where there's hatred, if I can only plant just a little bit of love, I know I'll never walk the pathway of life alone unless I choose to turn my back on the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and the things that you have given me. I don't think this will ever happen. In closing, I'd like to share with you my favorite poem, because I think you felt the touch too. You felt it through the members of AA and the other alcoholics, just as I felt it the night that I walked in the door and those AAs put their arms around me. You might not have recognized it, but it was battered and scarred. The auctioneer thought it scarcely worth his while to waste much time with the old violin. But he held it up with a smile. "What am I bid, good folks?" said he. "Who'll start the bidding for me? $1? $1. Not $2. $2. Who'll make it $3? $3 once, $3 twice, going for $3. But no. From the room far back, a gray-haired man came forward and picked up the book. Then, wiping the dust from the old violin and tightening up all the strings, he played a melody soft. Sweet, as sweet as an angel's. The music ceased. The auctioneer, in a voice that was soft and low, said, "What am I bid for the old violin?" Held it up with the bow. $1,000? Now $2. $2,000. Who'll make it $3? 3,000 once, 3,000 twice. Going and gone, said he. The people cheered and some of them cried. We do not quite understand what changed its worth. The man replied, the touch of the Master's hand. Is many a man his life out of tune, battered and torn with sin, their auction cheap to the thoughtless crowd, much like the old violin. A glass of beer, a bottle of wine, a game. He travels on. He's going once, going twice, going and almost gone. Then the Master comes. Foolish crowd, they never can quite understand the worth of the soul. Chains that was wrought by the touch of the Master. Thank you for not being willing to auction Mary and Meacham off to the thoughtless, the cruel crowd. Thank you for looking deep within my soul too and taking the time to realize that there was a worth to it, even though I had ended in the gutter in the jail. You knew that if I would ever become willing to accept your 12 steps, your tradition, your way of life and your love, and strive and have a desire and make a decision to practice the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous in all my affairs, all of them, that someday, somewhere, there would be a great change that could take place in my life. It was you that had the faith, the confidence. Had you not cared, I wouldn't be here. Thank you for making a 12-step call on me. You've helped me more than you'll ever know. God bless you.